Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Al-Qaeda needs a safe haven to be able to regenerate, and they found that now in the federally administrated tribal area of Pakistan.
National security official Fran Townsend speaking about the national intelligence estimate, which regrets to inform us that Al-Qaeda has regrouped in the mountains of Pakistan with a safe haven, still determined to attack the United States. So we'll ask the question now, what should the United States do? And we will get two views on that part of the NIE released this week, and what choices, including military ones, the U.S. and the government of Pakistan itself now face. With me now are Carlos Pascual, Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, and Max Boot, Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His forthcoming book is called War Made New, Weapons, Warrior, and the Making of the Modern World. Max Boot, welcome back. Carlos Pascual, welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning.
Carlos Pascual, what part of the country are we talking about? Americans are hearing this word Waziristan and don't know what that is.
They're essentially talking about the northwest part of the country, essentially bordering against Afghanistan. So if we think of a continuous area that can go from the northwest part of Pakistan into the southeast portions and the northwest portions of Afghanistan, an area where the Taliban can move freely back and forth, as well as Al-Qaeda intermingled with them, and an area which also happens to embed some of the principal jihadist groups in Pakistan, other groups such as the Kashmiri jihadists as well. So presenting quite an extensive threat across, cutting across two different nations.
And Max Boot, there is currently a ceasefire in effect between the government of Pakistan and Al-Qaeda in this region. This is something that the national security estimate criticized or questions the wisdom of, again, I think making it known to many Americans for the first time. How old is that ceasefire?
Well, the ceasefire you're referring to is not technically between the government of Pakistan and Al-Qaeda, although that has been, I think, its effect to some degree. There are a series of accords that were negotiated over the last 18 months in North and South Waziristan between the tribal leaders there and the government of Pakistan, on which the government of Pakistan essentially agreed to stop fighting against the Taliban and foreign militants in return for a promise from the tribal leaders to restrain those militants from staging further attacks. Now, as a lot of people predicted at the time, that's basically a surrender by the government of Pakistan because those tribal leaders have no intention of abiding by those empty promises. And what's been happening is that those federally administered tribal areas have turned into safe havens for the Al-Qaeda and Taliban, as the National Intelligence Estimate says. As a result of that, we have seen increasing attacks into Afghanistan from those areas against our troops and against our allies in Afghanistan, and we are seeing Al-Qaeda elements continuing their plotting in those very areas. And so those accords have been very disturbing, although in recent days, at least one of those accords has been breaking down in North Waziristan, and it looks like open fighting has resumed between the government of Pakistan and some of the local tribal and other groups.
Carlos, I gather that the Bush administration signed off on this decision by President Musharraf to have that ceasefire with the tribal leaders. Why was that?
I don't think that the Bush administration supported it. I think privately there was an indication that they felt that it would go the wrong way. Yet at the same time, there was a sense that there was a limit on how much the administration could push against Musharraf and still be able to maintain effective cooperation with him. The balance in cooperation between the United States and Pakistan has been a shaky one. And it reflects a reality that in the end, to be able to work effectively within another sovereign nation, you need to maintain the cooperation of that nation, and how far can you push and still be able to function. That inevitably takes some level of compromise. This is an indication where, one, the compromise was an extremely bad one, and we should have been able to have a much tougher dialogue about the realities that would be faced, because I agree completely with Max about the nature of the risks that are faced right now, and reinforces a bad decision that was made back in 2003, where in effect we reduced resources that we could have been using in Afghanistan and on that border and into Pakistan and redirected them into Iraq. And so at this point, we're paying for both of those bad decisions.
Max Boot, you've been a supporter of the Iraq War. Do you now also think that resources were diverted from this area, which now we know is still or again a safe haven for al-Qaeda, to go and fight in Iraq and create the conditions for a new al-Qaeda branch there?
Well, I certainly think we're a big country, and just as we were able to fight both the Germans and Japanese in World War II, we ought to be able to fight on several fronts in the war on terrorism. Now, unfortunately, the battle in Iraq has not gone well, and instead of drawing up support for terrorism there, we're actually increasing it. But I think the NIE makes a very important point, which is that there are close affiliations between al-Qaeda and Iraq and the central al-Qaeda leadership located probably in Pakistan, and that if we were simply to pull out of Iraq, that would hand a victory to al-Qaeda and would not help our cause, I think, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, I think where the Bush administration has, aside from all the errors they've made in Iraq, which are well known, I think they've made another fundamental error in Pakistan, which is to cast American policy 100% behind Pervez Musharraf. I think that has been a mistake. He is a dictator who has not delivered on many of the promises that he has made. We've essentially looked the other way as he has continued his unlawful and undemocratic rule because we thought that he would take on these militants for us. But what we've realized, or we should have realized early on, is that he's only going to take them up to a certain point. He's going to take them on to only at a certain point because the government of Pakistan, in particular the military, its inner services intelligence agency, are deeply complicit with a lot of these militants whom they've been using to advance their interests in Kashmir, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And so we can't count on this Pakistani military dictator to do exactly what we want.
And it's interesting that you bring that up, because here's another clip of Fran Townsend, the Homeland Security Advisor to the President, at that same news conference after the release of the National Intelligence Estimate, still backing up Musharraf.
President Musharraf, after the seizure of the Red Mosque, gave a speech and said he's going to root out extremism in every nook of Pakistan. And every indication is that President Musharraf takes this very seriously and is going after it.
So, Carlos Pascual, how much do you agree with what Max Boot just said, and how serious do you think President Musharraf really is, as Fran Townsend putting, you know, too positive a gloss on it?
I agree completely with Max, and I think that expecting that President Musharraf to have the capacity to root out extremism in every corner of Pakistan is simply unrealistic. It means that you have to have a military that has the capacity to go after Islamic militants and insurgents throughout the country, particularly in parts of Waziristan that we've been talking about before, operating in an extraordinarily complex environment where they're integrated with the Taliban and other jihadists. There's a lot of sympathy among parts of the military for some of those jihadist or extremist elements. There's a lot of insecurity about how confidential military actions and operations might actually be. Even if the military operates in many of those areas, the likelihood that it can sustain and maintain a strong and active presence in all of the relevant areas is not necessarily high. So will we see some increased action on the part of the Pakistani military? Most likely. Will we see it as a panacea that will fix this? Absolutely not. I think the other point that's important to underscore, and it builds on what Max said earlier, is that in the long term, the best thing for Pakistan is to be able to move back to a secular and democratic society. And that is an extremely difficult message and diplomatic mission to work with. What we've seen in other parts of the world is that if you allow authoritarian regimes to go on to the point where the only choice is between Islamic extremists and authoritarian rule and military rule, then the opening of a political window is likely to get you Islamic militants or extremists coming into government through political means. Right now, Pakistan has a real political movement, and the challenge for our diplomacy is to convince this president and the military that supports them that their best chance for the future is, in fact, to actually facilitate that transition to a democratic Pakistan. Not an easy thing to do.
Well, there's an article in the New York Times today that says, the headline, President of Pakistan Promises Elections and No Emergency Rule. Do you take Musharraf at his word on that, and does that represent the kind of democratic reform you're talking about?
I think that what we need to see is a very clear plan on how that's going to happen, and in particular, who's going to be allowed to contest those elections, and whether a strong opposition is going to be able to form, whether the key political participants are going to be let back into the country, whether they're going to be able to have access to the media, whether there's going to be a real democratic campaign that actually can be run. The other issue that obviously has to be addressed and settled is the question of the Supreme Court Justice Chaudhry and how that's going to evolve and play itself out, because that has become an overwhelmingly critical piece of the democratic picture, in the sense of whether or not Musharraf is actually willing to subject his government to the rule of law.
And Max Boot, it says in that New York Times article that if General Musharraf has drawn the ire of religious radicals, whom he had alternately threatened and cajoled, he has also faced bitter resistance from pro-democracy forces across the political spectrum. So how much do you agree with Carlos on his U.S. policy prescription, and how much strength do you think a pro-democracy movement does have in Pakistan?
I completely agree with Carlos that we should make the restoration of democracy our number one priority in Pakistan, and we have made a serious mistake by putting our ideals on hold in the hope that we would get some short-term benefits in fighting terrorism. And the result of that has been that there have been some short-term benefits, but they haven't been nearly as much as we want. And while we're backing this unelected dictator in Pakistan, we are turning more and more of the people of Pakistan against us, because they see the United States lining up behind a ruler who is increasingly unpopular. And while, yes, Musharraf is unpopular with some of the extreme Islamic radicals, he is also increasingly unpopular with the broad middle class of Pakistani society, which is outraged at the way that he tried to sack the Chief Justice of Pakistan, the way he's tried to curb press freedoms, the way he's done other things, which are increasingly costing him support. And the most people in Pakistan want a crackdown on the radicals. Most people supported Musharraf when he went after the Red Mosque in Islamabad, but they also want a restoration of democracy with Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif and other secular leaders in the opposition allowed to run and contest free elections, which is not something that Musharraf has allowed since he took power in 1999. And so I think while there are certainly dangers in making a transition here, I think we need to push the transition. We need to make clear to Musharraf we're not going to back him indefinitely. We want him to abide by the Constitution, which means by this fall he has to make a choice about whether he's going to continue as Army Chief of Staff or whether he's going to run and try to remain the political leader of Pakistan. We can't have him doing both. And he's repeatedly broken promises in the past to democratize and to hold free elections. And we have to hold his feet to the fire now. And we have real leverage here, because we have given Pakistan over $10 billion in aid since 2001. And we need to condition some of our support on a basic respect for democracy and freedom, which in the case of Pakistan, I don't think is going to lead to an Islamic takeover, because in the last elections, the radical Islamic parties got only 11% of the vote. Most Pakistanis are not in sympathy with these extremists who are setting off bombs.
I want to take one phone call that cycles back to what you said earlier, Max, about the relationship between al-Qaeda in Iraq and al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Saeed in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Saeed.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
I'm originally from Iran, and I have a very, very bad taste from your both experts. You have no idea about intelligence in the Middle East or Pakistan and Iran. First of all, there is not a single document has been provided by U.S. government, which I'm a citizen of this country, that issue a relationship with al-Qaeda in Iraq or al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Second issue, I am tired of the people keep saying pro-democracy and Islamists. There is no pro-democracy, there is no Islamists. The education part of Middle East and Pakistan and Afghanistan dictate by the mosque or madaris. They call it in Pakistan madaris, they call it in Iran mosque. So when you're dealing with an educated people that they're whole life is being dictated by religious, you can't introduce democracy. They're talking about bringing Bhutto back to Pakistan. This is a person that her husband completely emptied the treasury of Pakistan. What kind of democracy are you going to get from that? You're going to have more problems. The problem we have in this country, we want to apply the Western society rules to the countries that they've been only learned education-wise by Islamic rules.
Saeed, thank you for your call. And you raised, it wasn't the question I thought you were going to ask, but it's a very important question. And Carlos Pascual from Brookings, he refers to religious education, or let's say a certain type of intensely religious education, not being able to coexist with democracy. And that was the root of the issue that had Musharraf cracking down on the Supreme Court Justice, Chaudhry. It was over Pakistanis who were seen as overly religious or show an interest in radical Islamic thought, correct?
Well, there's several issues that were raised here, and if you don't mind, I think there's a particular important point here that we need to go back to in Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Al-Qaeda in Pakistan.
Go ahead.
Because the reality is that I agree that there have not been strong linkages that have been demonstrated between Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it's part of the danger that we're facing right now, where essentially what has happened is that there are franchises of Al-Qaeda that are arising in Iraq, in North Africa, potentially in other parts of the world, that are loosely linked and are creating their own sets of independent threats. And that has become part of the greater threat that we face today, and part of another challenge that is pointed out in the National Intelligence Agency estimate is that there has increasingly, with globalization, the movement of information and technology and communications, that there's a greater capacity for cells to operate independently in different parts of the world, and that to be able to effectively address this problem of terrorism, that we have to focus not just on the military aspects of it, but on international cooperation and addressing issues of law enforcement, intelligence cooperation, financial flows, diplomatic isolations, non-military dimensions. And interestingly, the National Intelligence Estimate says that what has been most successful, the one thing that actually has been deemed to work, is that kind of international cooperation. One of the things that we have seen that is key to that is, in fact, actually increasing the cooperation with Muslim countries. And what we have seen with the war in Iraq is that that has actually made it more difficult. And so we do face a dilemma here, and Max points to part of that dilemma. In the short term, a withdrawal of an American presence in Iraq will actually, I think, lead to greater chaos and even more fighting and spillover into the region. But it's also that very American presence that has been part of the draw that has allowed Al-Qaeda in Iraq to be able to draw 50 to 70 jihadists that are coming through Syria to act as suicide bombers within Iraq on a regular basis.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but let me play one more clip that I think is on point from Fran Townsend, the Homeland Security Advisor, the other day, and get your take on what this implies the U.S. should actually do to address the safe haven specifically in Pakistan. She's referring here to Musharraf.
Well, it doesn't say that his actions have made us less safe. What it says is Al-Qaeda has regenerated three things of four things that they need to launch an attack: safe haven, top leadership, and operational lieutenants. But let's be real clear. They are weaker than they were before September 11th, and we are stronger because we have built capabilities and alliances that we didn't have before September the 11th.
So, Carlos, let me go back to you on this to finish your point. And if Al-Qaeda has regenerated three things of four things that they need to launch an attack in the United States, safe haven, top leadership, and operational lieutenants, what should the U.S. do about it, and how can the international coalition building that you just talked about help keep us safe in the short run as well as the long run?
Well, first of all, critical reinforcement of international cooperation on law enforcement and intelligence, as we've just seen a number of times with the UK, unfortunately, that kind of cooperation is key both for disrupting terrorist plots in the UK and keeping them from coming to the United States. Secondly, finding ways to intensify that cooperation in the Muslim world, because increasingly we have seen that more and more of these activities are happening in Muslim states, and we have to find an understanding on how to be able to do that. In Pakistan, we face an absolutely horrible set of options. Max and I think both have agreed completely that in order to have any viable solution for the long term, one needs to manage a diplomatic process that helps move toward a democratic process in Pakistan. Yet it's those very same people, the president and the military, that are going to be key to any kind of short-term activity in the tribal areas that that might have any prospect for effectiveness. And so on the one hand, you're asking the military to play a more aggressive and effective role in the tribal areas. On the other hand, you're actually saying to the military and the president that for their long-term safety and for the good of the country, that they have to find a way to go back to civilian rule. Very hard set of policies
should
to manage.
Before you go, should the U.S. and NATO expand the war in Afghanistan militarily into this Waziristan section of Pakistan?
I think it would be a horrible option. The idea of American troops trying to act independently in that area where we're potentially attacked by multiple jihadist groups and put ourselves into confrontation with them would not only be bad in the region, but actually make it harder for us to get the kind of cooperation that we need in
the
Muslim world.
Max, we're almost out of time, but do you agree?
I think certainly we shouldn't, you know, invade Pakistan, but I think when opportunity arises, we ought to use our special operations forces and our air power to strike at al-Qaeda leadership or concentrations of al-Qaeda or training camps when those targets are there, even if there are some diplomatic repercussions.
Because Carlos, do you disagree? Isn't that the point of the Afghan war, to go get Osama bin Laden?
If the Pakistan government and army invited us to do that and do it in conjunction with them, and if they are willing to stand up and say that this is something that is done because they are requesting an international role in it, then I think we can consider it if we have clear intelligence that we can be effective. But we should be very, very clear-eyed about the negative fallout if we actually get it wrong.
Carlos Pasquale, Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. Max Boot, Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the forthcoming War Made New, Weapons Warrior and the Making of the Modern World. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.